Monitor Monday is recorded before a live online audience. From the studios of Rack Monitor, this is Monitor Monday for May 20th, 2024. Here's today's rundown. The science of medicine appears to be moving at the speed of light. But will new healthcare technologies be audit-proof? In New York, monitoring the changes and the impact on healthcare services is Rack Monitor investigative reporter Edward M. Roche with our lead story. We will also hear from Dr. Clarissa Barnes, Matthew Albright, and healthcare attorneys Nicole Emanuel and David Glazer. Now here's the publisher of Rack Monitor and the host of Monitor Monday, Chuck Buck.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Monitor Monday. We have a great deal of healthcare news to report, and we begin this morning with Dr. Clarissa Barnes. She's making her Monday rounds here on Monitor Monday.
Hello. As you may have guessed, I am not Dr. Hirsch. He's traveling and asked me to fill in for him today. My name is Dr. Clarissa Barnes, and I am an internist, current president of the American College of Physician Advisors, and the chief medical officer for South Dakota Medicaid. Medicare gets a lot of attention from physician advisors, which is partially historic owing to the conditions of participation that originated the UR committee and the administrative functions that gave rise to the physician advisor, and partially practical given the large number of hospitalized patients with Medicare or Medicare Advantage plans. However, as any pediatric physician advisor will tell you, Medicaid is a significant player in the payer space. Nationally, Medicaid is the largest payer for children and young adults. Medicaid covers 41% of all births and is the largest payer for long-term services and supports, as well as the largest single payer for services to treat substance use disorders and services to prevent and treat HIV. Now, I will admit that during my years as a physician advisor, I was relatively Medicare and Medicare Advantage focused. There was always plenty of work to do if you just focused on utilization review functions for the Medicare population. That being said, you'll be selling yourself and your organization short if you're not aware of the opportunities you have with Medicaid. So to that end, I wanted to make you aware of the Ensuring Access to Medicaid Services Final Rule, or CMS 2442F. Now, this one is easy to overlook, especially if you're inpatient focused. However, I wanted to draw your attention to a couple things hidden in there, so a couple little gems to note. This rule specifically states that states are required to publish fee-for-service Medicaid fee schedules, payment rates on a publicly available website. So even if your state is heavily managed, you likely still have some fee-for-service portions. And knowing these rates will give you insight into what they're expecting from their managed partners. Additionally, fee-for-service Medicaid will have to compare their primary care, OB-GYN, and outpatient mental health substance use disorder services to Medicare rates and publish it every 2 years. Now, and I think this is actually maybe more important for the inpatient folks, beyond the superficial renaming of the Medical Care Advisory Committee to the Medicaid Advisory Committee, or MAC, they're also establishing Beneficiary Advisory Councils, or BAC, for every state comprised of beneficiary families and or caregivers. Additionally, info about the MAC and BAC activities are going to be publicly available, including bylaws, agendas, minutes, membership lists, and meeting schedules. And at least two of those MAC meetings per year are going to be open to the public with a public comment period. The difference between trying to influence something on the federal level versus the state level is huge. And this level of transparency is only going to make it easier for you to get access to state decision makers. Best case, see if you can get on your state MAC. Worst case, start showing up for those twice a year public meetings. They're open to the public. There's no reason you can't attend. For all the physician advisors listening, I also wanted to remind you that the American College of Physician Advisors Mentorship Program, or CPAL, which stands for Cultivating Physician Advisor Leaders, is currently open for application for both mentors and mentees until 5/24 at acpaadvisors.org. You do have to be an ACPA member, but otherwise the program is free. And we're really looking forward to getting a pretty good cohort together. Thank you. And back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Barnes. That was the president and the CEO for the American College of Physician Advisors, Dr. Clarissa Barnes. She was substituting this morning for Dr. Ronald Hirsch. Here now with the Monitor Monday Rack Report is healthcare attorney Nicole Emanuel. And good morning, Nicole.
Hello, and happy Rack Monitor Monday. According to U.S. Department of Justice statistics released on February 22nd, the number of settlements, judgments, and civil investigative demands, or CIDs, under the False Claims Act, or FCA, was the highest in history for fiscal year ending September 30th, 2023. That same day, DOJ Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General Brian Boynton reported at the Federal Bar Association's QITAM conference that the U.S. was a party to 543 False Claims Acts or FCA settlements or judgments in fiscal year 2023. This was the most ever in a single year and a 54% increase from fiscal year 2022. So they also announced that the DOJ set a new record for issuing CIDs, which really does not surprise me. I normally defend about, like 3 to 6 CIDs a year. This past year, I started to defend 17 CIDs, which, I mean, is only possible because we have so many associates here at Nelson Mullins. But, that was a big jump. And the fraud section of USA also issued 1,504 CIDs for documents, interrogatory responses, and testimony in fiscal year 2023. While the $2.68 billion in total recoveries continues an upward trend from the $2.24 billion reported in fiscal year 2022. A primary takeaway is the focus on these investigations. In fiscal year 2023, more money was recovered from QITAM cases in which the U.S. intervened or prosecuted than in cases where the government declined to intervene, a near inverse from fiscal year 2022. As for new cases, whistleblowers filed 712 QITAM suits in fiscal year 2023 and received over $349 million, a considerable decrease from the $496 million in fiscal year 2022. So DOJ-initiated cases also increased substantially with 500 new matters in fiscal year 2023, up from 305 in fiscal year 2022. With fiscal year 2023 in the books, recoveries from the FCA since the 1986 amendments now exceed $75 billion and have exceeded $2 billion annually for 15 consecutive years. And healthcare remains a key enforcement priority in 2024. I mean, healthcare has always been the largest area of enforcement and recovery, throughout history. That is where most of the billions of dollars the government gets back comes from. Now, the DOJ continues to prioritize the pursuit of pandemic-related fraud schemes, resolving approximately 270 FCA matters in connection with improper payback protection program loans in fiscal years 2023 and recovering more than $48.3 million. That's a lot. And what that goes to show you is that the government, they put their money where their mouth is. They put so much more money into the program to combat fraud this past year. And so much more money gets put into that. There's going to be a lot more CIDs and audits. Back to you, Chuck.
Thank you, Nicole, very much. That was Nicole Emanuel, Nicole's department law firm with Nelson Mullins. And coming up at about 10 minutes after the hour in your time zone, you're going to hear from healthcare attorney David Glazer, Matthew Albright, plus Rack Monitor investigative reporter Edward M. Roach. He's standing by in New York to report our late story. Folks, it is Monday. It's May 20th, and you're listening to the live edition of Monitor Monday.
As artificial intelligence applications rapidly expand, healthcare organizations and practitioners are eager to harness the benefits of these technologies. With limited experience and understanding of these powerful tools, there is a crucial need for guidance to ensure their effective and compliant use. Join expert Michelle Wazorek as she addresses the pressing challenges faced by healthcare organizations adopting AI within the clinical revenue cycle. Tomorrow's webcast will delve into real-world AI adoption cases, exploring the benefits and limitations. Learn critical issues such as the validation of AI algorithms, the importance of human validation in machine learning, and the delineation of responsibilities between buyers and vendors. The webcast, Navigating AI and Healthcare Revenue Cycle, Maximizing Efficiency, Minimizing Risks, is tomorrow, May 21st at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. Register to attend at the Rack University Bookstore.
Here now with the Monitor Monday Risky Business Report is healthcare attorney David Glaser. David, as I say every Monday morning about the same time, what could be risky today?
Well, Chuck, it's the risk that you will panic when you discover your organization offers discounts to a small number of patients and conclude that you have a gigantic overpayment because you charged Medicare more than those patients. So I had a situation recently where another law firm learned that an organization had a lower cash price that it offered to a very small subset of patients. The law firm suggested that the discount converted all of the other charges to Medicare into false claims and recommended that a refund big enough that it would cover the salary of a star baseball player for maybe only just a year, maybe even two. While I readily agree that having disparate prices can create a host of issues, it's simply wrong to assert that you must charge Medicare your lowest price. So Medicare has a definition for its usual and customary charge. The wording is quite unusual. Bear with me as I slog through it. Cheyenne has been kind enough to put it in the comments for those of you who are listening live. So you're going to look to 42 CFR section 405.503B as in boy. So the regulation defines customary charges as, and this is a quote, the uniform amount which the individual physician or other person charges in the majority of cases for a specific medical procedure or service. So simplifying that a bit, if more than half of your patients are charged the same price for a service, then that's automatically your usual and customary charge. Of course, in healthcare, it's pretty rare that the same price is paid by a majority of your patients. So in that case, the regulation continues, once again a quote, if the individual physician or other person varies his charges for a specific medical procedure or service so that no one amount is charged in the majority of cases, it will be necessary for the carrier to exercise judgment in the establishment of a customary charge for such physician or other person. In making this judgment, an important guide to be utilized when a sufficient volume of data on the physician's or other person's charges is available would be the median or midpoint of his charges. And this is an important part, excluding token and substandard charges, as well as exceptional charges on the high side. A significant clustering of charges in the vicinity of the median amount might indicate that a point of such clustering should be taken as the physician or other person's customary charge. Use of relative value scales will help in arriving at a decision in such instances. So the bottom line is that Medicare is not entitled to the lowest price that you charge anyone. In fact, you can have 40 or 45% of your patients paying less than Medicare and still be legal. So I think a lot of people don't know about this, and it certainly is conventional wisdom that you can't charge the government, you know, more than you charge anyone else. That's common sense. It's almost axiomatic. It just isn't true with respect to Medicare. Now, that isn't to say different prices won't create other issues. They may. And Medicaid has different rules in many states, it might require you to give Medicaid the lowest rate. We were talking in the pre-chat about how Medicaid has different rules in every state, so knowing what it is in California doesn't help you at all in Nevada. but in some states, Medicaid is entitled to your lowest price. But you won't have a Medicare overpayment. So the bottom line is that if fee schedules could talk, or maybe sing, in situations where more than half of your patients are paying more than Medicare, the fee schedule would choose ELO, the Electric Light Orchestra. Don't bring me down. No, 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 no. Don't bring me down. Gruce. And Chuck, I don't know what a gruce is. It sounds a lot like a ruse. And you have to be careful in how you do it. But having some people pay less than Medicare isn't inherently a ruse. Chuck, you never bring me down. And I turn it back to you.
Thanks, David, very much for that uplifting comment. That was healthcare attorney David Glazer. David is a shareholder in the law firm of Fredrickson and Byron in downtown Minneapolis. Up next, Matthew Albright with a Monitor Monday legislative update.
The legislative update is sponsored by Zealous. Zealous is modernizing the healthcare financial experience by bridging the gaps and aligning interests across payers, providers, and healthcare consumers.
Here now is Matthew Albright.
In the year before a presidential election, when there is a chance that the White House may change occupants after November, administrations often push their agendas through federal actions, such as regulations and guidance coming out of the federal departments so they can go around Congress. So while this election year, we are not expecting Congress to get much done in terms of actual legislation, we can expect the Biden administration to ramp up its efforts at pushing things through at the regulatory level. An excellent example of this is the proposed rule published late last week that would, in essence, make marijuana legal for medicinal use across the country. The rule, coming out of the Drug Enforcement Agency under the Department of Justice, proposes that marijuana be changed to a Schedule III substance under the Controlled Substances Act. Now, marijuana is currently categorized as a Schedule I substance. A Schedule I substance is defined as a substance in which there's a high potential for abuse, no current medical use, and a lack of accepted safety for use, even under medical supervision. Last week's DEA proposed rule follows a determination from HHS last summer that the drug, marijuana, has accepted medical uses and is less dangerous than other Schedule I drugs. Other Schedule I drugs include heroin and LSD. This move by the administration probably triggers more questions than answers, at least with respect to its regulatory challenges. Nearly 40 states have already passed laws that legalize medical use of marijuana, though there is little in the way of state rules on prescriptions, record keeping, and other administrative and safety guardrails around the medicinal use of marijuana. Although the rule would reclassify marijuana would still be a controlled substance, which means that federal prosecution is still a risk to anyone who traffics in the drugs or, quote, prescribes the drugs without the appropriate approvals and processes. Perhaps just as important as what this proposed rule would do is what the rule would definitely not do. For instance, the proposed rule would not federally legalize marijuana grown and sold for recreational use. 24 states now allow the sale of recreational cannabis. As another example of this, the newly proposed rule, if it was finalized, would not get any people out of jail who have been jailed for growing or selling marijuana. Relatedly, the rule would not give the cannabis industry access to credit card and payment systems. It is also very unclear what this means for the U.S. drug and our healthcare industry at large, as our listeners can well imagine. Could gummies now be bought at the neighborhood cannabis store? And could those gummies now be covered by insurers and bought with your HSAs or your FSA? We are basically at the beginning of what may be a long rulemaking process before the rescheduling actually takes place. However, how long is another question? As listeners know, some rules that have very popular support can move quickly from proposed rule to final rule within a year. Other rules can take years. Regardless, we can pretty much expect that the Biden administration is going to push this through as quickly as they can. Chuck, This may be just the latest in a number of actions that will be taken up this election year by the Biden administration. We're going to keep our eyes on it.
Thanks, Matthew, very much. That was Matthew Albright. Matthew is the chief legislative analyst for Zealous.
Maintaining strict regulatory compliance continues to be a challenge. A variety of factors, including a deluge of regulatory news, make it feel like you're navigating turbulent waters. So now, more than ever, you need to be sure everyone on your team, including those who work remotely, is following the same guidance and moving in the same direction. A subscription to Rack Monitor Compliance Webcast is your port in the storm. For a single money-saving fee, your entire team can access the full library of exclusive Rack Monitor educational webcasts featuring nationally acclaimed compliance and audit experts. Register at the Rack University Bookstore today.
As you heard us mention at the top of the broadcast, the science of medicine appears to be moving at the speed of light. But are these new healthcare technologies audit-proof? Well, standing by to report our lead story in New York is Rack Monitor investigator reporter Ed Roach. And good morning, Ed.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
Good, thanks.
The magic of molecular pathology labs, cold rooms, sterile rooms, dark rooms, autoclaves, Mili-Q water systems, dry ice, liquid nitrogen, fluorescence microscopes, confocal microscopes for 3D images, electron microscopes for high-resolution subcellular structures. Molecular diagnostics are a powerful healthcare tool relying on cloning, polymerase chain reaction, nucleic acid electrophoresis, DNA microarray analysis, in situ hybridization, and next-generation sequencing. Biomarker tests, genetic tests, analysis of tumors, liquid biopsies, isothermal amplification reaction, DNA microarrays, and the enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, which finds antibodies, antigens, proteins, and hormones from body fluids. And molecular pathology is a growth industry. The global molecular biology enzymes market will grow from $19 billion today to $66 billion by 2033. Biological reagents from $11 billion to $22 billion. The global molecular diagnostics market has a compound annual growth rate of 16%. Molecular pathology is not audit proof. CMS has complex billing and coding rules. There are four subgroups of CPT codes. Number one, genomic sequencing procedures. Number two, multi-analyte with algorithmic analyses. Number three, proprietary laboratory analyses. And number four, Tier 1, Tier 2 for analyte-specific and rare disease low-volume molecular pathology. CMS does not cover many molecular pathology tests, including any preventative screening for a genetic abnormality in the absence of a suspicion of an active disease. Molecular pathology tests for diseases that manifest severe symptoms in newborns and early childhood or that result in early death, automatic claim denial. Any test given without visible symptoms of disease. Determination of whether or not you can pass on a genetic disease to descendants. Screening for hereditary cancer syndromes. Prenatal diagnostic testing. Tests to determine the risk of getting a disease. Any investigational test. All those claims are denied. CMS changes in coding rules appear designed to take payments away from testing laboratories. For example, one study examined the record of two molecular oncology tests, a T-cell receptor beta test, and a 467-gene cancer panel. CMS coding reforms bypassed stacked procedural codes. The T-cell test became a Tier 1. The cancer panel, a Tier 1 and 2. The result? For the T-cell test, a 61% drop in reimbursements, followed by an increase in rejection rates. The cancer panel test scored a 48% drop in reimbursements and sharp increase in rejection rates. The result? Less testing, poorer healthcare providers, and less funds for innovation. Remember during COVID, testing kits were given away for free? The United States needs less audits and universal molecular diagnostics for everyone. Has anyone considered a national testing program giving each pre-teenager citizen a comprehensive battery of genetic testing, then using this information to tell them what diseases they are vulnerable to and make suggestions about how to take care of their health, such as dietary restrictions, exercise regime, and many other factors? Such guidance already is available from commercial DNA testing services many persons use to trace their ancestry. Health monitoring systems associated these days with mobile phones or smartwatches would be accessed for each citizen. Algorithms would provide suggestions for better behavior or advance warnings for unhealthy habits. Lighter auditing and molecular diagnostics for all. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Ed, very much. That was RackModern investigative reporter Edward M. Roach. Mr. Roach is the Director of Business Intelligence for Barraclough LLC in New York. And that's going to be a wrap for this live edition of Monitor Monday. We thank you so very much for being with us today. And a special thank you to our panelists today, Matthew Albright, Dr. Carissa Barnes, who substituted for Dr. Ronald Hirsch, Nicole Emanuel, David Glazer, and of course, RackModern investigative reporter Edward M. Roach. He reported our lead story this morning from New York. And one more thing before we go. There's going to be a very special broadcast tomorrow on Talk to Intuition. That's going to feature our world-renowned psychiatrist, Dr. H. Stephen Moffitt. And by the way, folks, there won't be a Monitor Monday broadcast next Monday, but we will be back here Monday, June 3rd. So have a great and compliant Memorial Day weekend. Until tomorrow, on Talk to Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck, reporting for Rack Monitor, Monitor Monday. Have a great week, everybody.
Monitor Monday is a presentation of Rack Monitor.